I have really been impressed to preach from the Old Testament. And I guess of all the passages, Genesis chapter 3 probably has more to say to modern day science than perhaps any other passage in the Old Testament, other than, with exception of the flood itself, which we're going to look at in a few weeks to come. The earthquake in California this week reminded us that we are living in a world where man is at odds with his environment. We're reminded of that sometimes things happen that are totally beyond our control, and the end result is we experience pain, sorrow, discomfort. Where did all of that originate? It goes back to Genesis chapter 3. You won't read about pain, you won't read about sorrow, you won't read about any tensions in Genesis 1 and 2 among God's creation. All of that comes about as a result of the curse in Genesis chapter 3. And folks, this is not just a fairy tale. This is not just something that we'll relate to children, or to relate to children that sounds good, but it really isn't true. Modern day science is discovering more and more what the Bible has proclaimed all along. And we'll see that as we look at this passage in Genesis chapter 3. Now you'll notice that in the same order that the sin occurred, through the serpent to Eve, then to Adam, in the same order the serpent, Eve, and then Adam are sentenced with different degrees of heartache, problems that would come into their lives. But notice that the serpent, beginning in verse 14, because he did this, and he was ultimately the one responsible through whom Satan spoke, he would be more cursed than all of the other animals of the field. And the end result was that God would put enmity between the serpent and the seed of the woman. And this is all prophetic of the anticipated struggle that would occur upon Calvary now as we look back 2,000 years ago. The question is, why was the serpent's curse here so severe? And the answer is because Satan himself was such an incorrigible old personage that the end result was that in his hatred, in his bitterness, because of his fault, he was like the AIDS patient who decides that because he's going to die, because his life is going to result in destruction, that the end result is he will take as many with him as he possibly can. And that's what Satan is doing. He is taking as many with him to hell as he possibly can, because he knows that's where he is going to end up. And young people, that's what he's doing today. Adults, that's what he's doing today. He is inciting us to do evil in order that he might put his hook into us and ultimately bring about destruction in our lives. And God says because of that, his sentence is going to be more severe than Adam and Eve. In fact, Adam and Eve have the promise that they have a Redeemer who will come and redeem them. But not Satan, because he is beyond the possibility of redemption. Now, who was this serpent? Or what was this serpent? You know, many surmise that the serpent here was perhaps a four-legged creature or something that stood upright before the curse, but now it becomes an animal that will literally crawl on its belly. Gary Richmond, who was a former zookeeper in Los Angeles, has written a book entitled All of God's Creatures, and I know that many of you have used that book in your homeschooling. It's an excellent little book, in which he contends that the serpent was really a dragon. And his primary reason for contending that is because Satan is referred to as a dragon. Remember in Revelation chapter 12, in Revelation chapter 20, it says that serpent of old, the devil, the dragon. So the Satan takes on the imagery of a dragon or a predatory animal. And it may very well be that prior to the fall, that the serpent here really was a dragon. We don't know that, and frankly, I don't think it's all that important what he was before. But I do believe it's important to notice that whatever it was before, from now on, it would crawl upon its belly. It would literally eat the dust. It would be more humbled than any other animal. Now notice, it says, you are more cursed than all the cattle, more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. I believe, though some would probably question me here, I believe that this serpent was literally a snake at this point. God made it a snake. And that every time we see that snake, it is a reminder to us of our sin problem. It is a perennial reminder to humanity that we have a sin problem. It is also a reminder to humanity that Satan ultimately is cursed, that he is doomed to defeat, that he is doomed to lick the dust of the opposition, who happens to be the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, we have a saying, and I told this in the early service. Several of my close friends were there who loved to hear me talk about my days in high school. But I was active in athletics, and I was known as a pretty fast runner in our area of the country. In fact, I won the 100-yard dash. I can say that now. I mean, that was 33 years ago or whatever, 34. I won the 100-yard dash and 220-yard dash in our county 3 years in a row, and I thought I was pretty fast. And then I decided that I would enter a competition called the Mansfield Relays, which had about five different states, fast runners from five different states. And I was involved in winning a heat or two in that. And finally, I was put in this heat with, lo and behold, of all men, Paul Warfield. Any of you remember the name Paul Warfield? He was a receiver for the Cleveland Browns and later for the Miami Dolphins. Extremely fast, even in the NFL. And I ended up in this heat with six other guys. I came in last in my heat. In fact, in that particular heat. In fact, after 10 yards, I began to wonder if my legs were working. Because these guys were so far out in front of me, they could have made a film on my life at that moment entitled, White Men Can't Run. I was the only white man in that heat. And I've told that story. When I tell it, you know what I say? I say, you know, those guys left me in their dust. That phrase, left me in their dust, originated in Genesis chapter 3. What does it mean? In Micah chapter 7, verse 17, the prophet Micah foresees the day when Jerusalem will be the center of the world during the millennial reign of Christ. And it says that all of the nations shall lick the dust, speaking of Israel. They'll lick the dust of Israel. Israel will be supreme. Israel will be primary, and all of the other nations will have to bow before the nation of Israel. It means humiliation. It speaks of defeat. And what God is saying to Satan is every time we see that serpent, it will remind us of the sin problem in our lives, but it will also remind us that Satan has ultimately been defeated. That we have a Redeemer. In Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15 is the first what our early church fathers called proto-evangelium, meaning the first proclamation of the gospel, that there would come the seed of woman, and there would always be this tension between the seed of woman and the seed of Satan, but ultimately the seed of woman, who was Christ, born of the seed of woman, Galatians chapter 4, that ultimately this seed, though Satan would appear as though he'd won a victory at Calvary by the crucifixion of Jesus, he was only literally bruising his heel. But Jesus, at that same moment, was literally crushing the head of Satan. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 15, he made a public display of them, triumphing over them in it. In what? The cross. So Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15 speaks of the ultimate defeat and the total destruction of Satan, which will take place in the book of Revelation. Now, I want to go on to the woman because I know many of you are asking questions and have been. Some of you even thought I was going to avoid this passage altogether, and I'm not going to do that. We're going to hit it head on right now. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children, and your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. What God is saying to the woman is, because you allowed yourself to be deceived by Satan, and the woman was the one who was first deceived, because of that, the woman is sentenced to have problems in two areas. One would be in the bearing of children. God never intended for pain to be a part of man's experience. When Adam and Eve were going to bring forth their first child, had sin not entered, I believe that there would have been no pain. Pain is a result of the curse. And that's why when we get to Revelation chapter 21 and verse 4, it says, God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more pain, neither sorrow coming from pain, nor crying, for all of the former things are passed away. The curse will have been lifted, and man's environment will once again be pain-free, without sorrow. Woman experiences pain in childbirth. And every time you mothers have a baby, it reminds you, just as the snake reminds you of the sin problem we all have, so every time a baby is born, it reminds a mother, it reminds all of us of the problem of sin. God put all these built-in reminders into our environment to remind us that we have a sin problem that needs to be dealt with, and He is the one who took the initiative to deal with it. Everywhere we look, we see that. The very thing which was to bring joy into woman's life would temporarily bring pain. Not only in the bearing of children. There's tremendous pain, as only you women who've had children can verify. But there's also tremendous joy once the child is born. The same thing is true in a woman's relationship with her husband. There is tremendous pain at times in that relationship. My wife would tell you that I brought a lot of pain into our marriage. But I have to remind her every now and then, I've also brought a lot of joy into our marriage. Sometimes she doesn't buy that argument. I have to convince her. I have to cite individual circumstances. Remember? Remember our honeymoon? Sometimes you have to go back a ways, you know? Pain and joy, that would be man's experience. So even in the sentence itself, God has sort of put in a redemptive factor that even pain itself becomes a good thing in man's experience. Because without pain, we can end up hurting ourselves. I was talking to, we had a number of people that joined the church last night at our new members' fellowship, and at least four of the guys were doctors, and we got involved in a discussion about pain. And I was telling a couple of the men about this book, written by Dr. Paul Brandt, who was a missionary doctor in India for a number of years, who wrote this book along with Philip Yancey, and it's entitled Pain, the Gift That Nobody Wants. But the blessings of pain, I highly recommend the book to you. The blessings of being able to experience pain in a fallen world is incredibly good for us. And he uses the illustration of the leper whose feet, the nerve endings are damaged so that the leper can feel absolutely no pain in his feet. He ends up damaging his feet, almost destroying his feet, and he doesn't even know it because he feels nothing. So that God is so good in that He allows us even to experience pain, not only you women in bearing children, but even in our relationships between husbands and wives. God uses it in a very positive and wonderful way. Now, there's been an ongoing tension between husbands and wives traced back to this point. In fact, I could make it broader than that and say that there's been an ongoing tension between women and men that goes back to Genesis chapter 3. Every time you see women demonstrating for equal rights, and the method, the motivation behind that sometimes is because they have been hurt by so many men in their lives, by their fathers, by their husbands, by others, that the only thing they can do is react in bitterness against all men. And we're seeing that. We even saw that last night. The trial is a result of the outcome of the Bobbitt decision this week and the demonstrations. But let it be reminded that every time you see women demonstrating for equal rights and holding up signs and banners proclaiming equality for women, that it's a problem that goes back to Genesis chapter 3, and it's again another sign, another verification that man has a sin problem and he's out of sync with the Creator. Now, the evolutionist doesn't have any explanation for the differences in the sexes. He can't tell you even how physically there is the distinction between the male and the female. It would be an incredible scenario of events to think that the woman and the man evolved in such a way, at such a time, and in such a manner that all at once they developed the ability through their differences to be able to procreate the human race. That takes an incredible amount of faith to believe that. I personally believe it's much easier to believe that there was a creator who did it all. And then if the evolutionists could count for the difference between men and women physically, how can he account for the difference between men and women emotionally and intellectually? We're different creatures. I'm still trying to find out what makes my wife tick. And I know she would tell you there are still so many things that she knows that I don't know about her. And your wife would say the same thing about you. There is such a difference between us that there is always that tension. And I believe that the tension, going back to Genesis chapter 3, is this. Adam abdicated his responsibility to be a leader in the home. And I think underlying all of Genesis chapter 3, if you read it carefully, is this. You ask the question, where was Adam when all of this happened? Where was Adam when Eve was deceived? Why wasn't he taking a more active role in leadership? And because Adam was absent and Adam took no leadership initiative here, all at once the reins of leadership are turned over to Eve. And it upset creation and the beginning, and it continues to compound the problems of creation up to this very moment. The tension. It's there between men and women and husbands and wives. I think the last part of verse 16, by the way, is really putting the finger on the problem in human relationships between a husband and wife. Your desire shall be for your husband. He shall rule over you. The same statement occurs in chapter 4 and verse 7, where God is addressing Cain. He says, if you do well, will your offering not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you. But you shall rule over it. What he's saying is, Cain, if you don't respond, if you don't take the initiative, sin will always be lying at the door, ready to step in and master you. And in the same way, he's saying to Adam and to Eve here, Adam, if you don't take the responsibility of being a leader in your home and in your relationship with your wife, you're always going to find that your wife is tempted to step in there and take over the reins of leadership and master you. And one of the great problems in our society today is that men have abdicated their responsibility for being leaders in the home, and women, out of sheer pressure and feeling the need to do something, have taken over the reins of leadership. And we have a whole generation of young people that are being lost today simply because man has become passive in his relationships. And that was the problem with that. Now I want you to turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 2. Many have asked me about this passage, and this is a good time to look at it because it goes back to creation. 1 Timothy chapter 2, beginning with verse 11, where Paul says, I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. Why? Here's the reason. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. Adam was not deceived. Paul makes that clear. Adam was not deceived. The only thing I can say is that Adam just simply refused to lead when he should have been leading. He refused to be a covering for Eve when he should have been a covering for Eve. Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in love and holiness with self-control. Now, I'm not going to try to expound this whole passage, but I want to cite two things that I believe are clearly taught from this passage. Number one, that whatever Paul's saying in these verses is tied in with creation and the fall. Adam was created first. Eve was the first one to be deceived. The order was reversed. And something, either because of her circumstances or because of her mental, spiritual, emotional makeup, or even the fact that perhaps Adam had become passive and no longer led as a man ought to lead, that the end result was she was more open to the deceiver than was Adam. And because of this, secondly, I believe Paul is saying here that the woman is to take a role of submission in the home and allow her husband to lead, but there's always going to be that tension between the woman allowing the husband to lead and the husband taking the leadership role. Always be that tension, and all of our marriages today reflect that, don't they? To one degree or another. And bringing man into the picture as her trusted advisor and leader, she's building a wall of protection around her that makes her less susceptible to the deceiver. And believe me, if Shirley MacLaine had had a protective covering, she might not be out on a limb. You ever wonder, where was Shirley MacLaine's husband when all this was being written, all these wild ideas being propagated? Does she have a husband? Who is he? Got to be a wimp. The guideline is not given to limit a woman's ministry, but it's to limit the deceiver from further access into her life so that she can even be more effective in her ministry. And the position that I've taken when it comes to women being involved in the ministry of the church, and I realize that I might be out on a limb when I say this, about to saw it off, by the way. The context of everything that Paul is saying here in 1 Timothy 2 is in the context of the church when it's assembled together for worship publicly as we are here this morning. Paul says whenever the church is assembled, a woman ought to take a submissive role and the man ought to be the teacher. Because God is the head of Christ, 1 Corinthians 11, Christ is the head of man and man is the head of woman. And just as Christ put himself under in submission to and under the authority of the Father, in the same way man is to put himself under authority and in submission to Christ, in the same way the woman is to submit to her husband. And husbands, if we are submitting to Christ and loving our wives as Christ loved the church, then it's going to be so much easier for the wife to want to put herself under us. You women can say amen, even if the men can't. You women can say amen at that point. I often, when the entire church is assembled, it ought to be the man's responsibility to do the teaching. But in Sunday school classes, I believe even in adult Sunday school classes, if a woman is willing to build male leadership around her as a protective covering, there's no limit to what she can do even in adult Sunday school classes. I mentioned this morning that Miss Johnson, the founder and leader of BSF, has had an incredible ministry that reaches around the world. But Miss Johnson recognized the biblical order here and was willing in the very beginning of time to put men who were godly men over her so that she could be under their submission. And the result is that God chose to bless that ministry greatly. And I believe she's a model for all women across America and across the world. I often think of two Belgian workhorses we had when I was a kid. About 7 years of age, their names were Belle and Queen. Belle was wild. You wonder where I'm going with this one, don't you? She was wild. I remember riding one day on Belle. All we had were some reins on her, but no saddle, and I was on her about 6 or 7 years of age. My dad was on Queen, the other horse, more passive. And Queen was so gentle and so docile, and my father had my younger brother on with him, and all at once the horse I was on, Belle, just got one of these wild streaks, and she took off the side of the road, up through the ditch, jumped over this little barbed wire fence and off into this cornfield, totally out of control. My dad was scared to death that something was going to happen to me. And I remember that moment because it was so traumatic. And I remember the difference between those horses, that Belle was so domineering and so wild. She was the leader of the team, and Queen was just so passive and so submissive. But I remember how my dad used to say, you know, son, these two horses make a wonderful team together. But if both horses would have been dominant, by the way, they were both female, if both horses would have been dominant, they wouldn't have made a team. In every area of life, we recognize the importance of team. But in every team, there has to be a captain. In every industry, in every business, you men who are in business, when something happens at your place of business and you have a dissatisfied customer, the first thing that customer does is he comes in and he says, I want to speak to the manager. I want to speak to the owner of this place. Why? Because he wants to know who's in charge. Somebody has to be in charge. You watch the football game today and you're going to see the Montana Rice principle. No, it's no longer Montana Rice, but you're going to see the Aikman-Irwin principle, okay? Troy Aikman is the leader. He's the one that calls the shots. He's the one who does the passing. And it's Michael Irwin, who's going to do the receiving. We recognize that in every team sport, there has to be a captain, there has to be a leader. We recognize it when we get on a plane. We get on a plane, we don't want to know who are the pilots, we want to know who is the pilot, who is the co-pilot. Somebody has to be in charge. When you drive away from the church today, you get in your car, you're not going to have two people on the steering wheel.
Well, some of you might. I really, let me rethink that. Now, it's like I heard one guy say, well, you know, my wife drives a car. I just hold on to the steering wheel. And that might be your experience. But somebody has to do the driving. And God says, when it comes to the home, whenever there's a problem in the home, God says, I want to go to the one who's in charge. And God says, the one who's in charge is the man. And male, man, husband, father, you have got to take the initiative in being a leader. The great problem sociologists are telling us in our country today is that we're raising a whole generation of young people who don't even know who their fathers are. And that's a tragedy. And we're going to see the evil fruits of that for so long in our society. I feel so burdened about that I just feel it's necessary on this passage to really talk to the men. And I want to do that in weeks to come. You know, the name husband means manager, steward. That's what the word husband means. A husbandman, a manager, a steward, a caretaker. It implies the one who is in charge. God says, man, you're in charge. That's why when I counsel people, I go to the man. I say, man, you're probably the problem. And if you get to the root of your problem, you're going to find that your wife, because God has built into her that extreme desire to want to submit to someone who loves her, she will follow you. I love the words of Judy Garland. I didn't know she was such a wise woman until I read these words. She said, millions of words have been written on how a man should love a woman. I would like to give you my reflections on the things a man should not do in loving a woman. First, don't yield your leadership. That's the main thing. Don't hand us the reins. We would consider this an abdication on your part. It would confuse us. It would alarm us. It would make us pull back. Quicker than anything else, it would fog the clear vision that made us love you in the first place, men. Oh, we will try to get you to give up your position as number one in the house. That's the terrible contradiction in us. It goes back to Genesis 3:16. We will seem to be fighting you to the last ditch for final authority on everything for a while, but in the obscure recesses of our hearts, we want you to win. You have to win, for we weren't really made for leadership. It's a pose. I'm glad I didn't write that. Judy Garland, bless her heart. Now the man, quickly the man. What does he say to the man? Man, you're also going to have a problem in two areas. One is labor. Everything's going to be more difficult. Cursed is the ground for your sake, and toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. You're never going to be able to stay ahead of the soil. It's always going to turn into thorns and thistles. Work is going to come much more difficult as a result of the curse. God never intended it for that before the curse. It says, because you've listened to your wife. Look at that. Verse 17. Some would say that man hasn't listened to his wife since. Doesn't mean you never listen to your wife. And when it comes to doing evil, you never listen to your wife. And wife, you never listen to your husband when it comes to doing evil. But he says that because of the curse, man's sentence is now hard labor and then death. In fact, it's interesting. The word in verse 17 for toil is the same word that's used for pain, the labor pains of the woman in verse 16. So the man's life now out in the marketplace becomes extremely difficult. It becomes toilsome, burdensome. He experiences pain just as real in the emotional realm as the physical pain of the woman in the midst of childbirth. So woman has her labor pains, man has his labor pains. Toil. Everything becomes more difficult. And all of you guys can identify with that. And that's why we see all of these bumper stickers. I'd rather be fishing. I'd rather be golfing. But let me tell you, because of the curse, even fishing and golfing aren't what we'd like for them to be. You know, you go fishing and you end up getting a hook in your finger and you don't catch any fish. You say, where's the fun in this? And you go out and play golf, and you can't hit the ball the same way every time. There's no consistency. I have a feeling that before the curse, if Adam would have picked up golf, he would have been an absolutely perfect golfer. Isn't Christianity practical? You won't get this kind of stuff from Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer. They won't tell you what the real problem is. The real problem in the golf swing is sin. It is. Goes back to Genesis 3. It's another reminder, because nothing turns out the way we want it to do and we can't do the things that we would like to do. It's a reminder to us of man's problem of sin. Furthermore, he says, in the sweat of your brow you're going to have to earn a living. Man never perspired before the curse. Every time you see sweat beads break out of my head, it's a reminder to you that I've got a sin problem, you've got a sin problem. Isn't it interesting that men sweat more than women? So I wonder why I sweat more than my wife does. Because of the curse. That's right. And furthermore, man's ending. He came from the dust and he's going to go back to the dust. You realize it's only been in the last 100 years that scientists have discovered what the Bible's proclaimed all along, and that is that the basic elements of life are found in the dust of the earth. But the Bible's proclaimed that all along. Dust, man came from dust, and man will go back to dust, so that in reality his life just becomes one dismal experience after another until finally he dies. God in his grace does not allow him to eat from the tree of life for fear that he'll perpetuate this fallen state forever. So God in his grace drives man out of the garden. The old saying is there are no U-Hauls behind the hearse. Man comes in with nothing. He goes out with nothing. He came from dust, and he returns to dust. But God in his grace, notice, verse 20. Verse 21, also for Adam and his wife, the Lord God made tunics of skin and clothed them. Built all these reminders into man's experience of sin. All these reminders that man has a sin problem, that he's out of sync with his creation, he's out of sync with his creator. And so God moves to provide tunics of skin, proper clothing for Adam and Eve in their fallen state and their nakedness. And somewhere in that garden, two innocent victims, two helpless animals, were probably slaughtered right in front of Adam and Eve, and they were skinned, and they took their skins, and God clothed them as a reminder of what he would ultimately do in the person of his own son, that a life would be given for life, blood for blood. And that's what God did at Calvary. How beautiful our God is. How wonderful he is. How gracious he is. How marvelous he is in that he provides for our needs for eternity. He moved to reconcile us to himself. Not by works of righteousness, which we have done, but according to his own mercy, he has saved us by the washing of regeneration, renewing the Holy Spirit, Titus 3:5. God is the one who provides the clothing. Whatever we can do to try to cover our moral failure and our sin is always inadequate. Only God can cover our fallenness. Only God can deal with our sin problem. We have a sin problem. Genesis 3 testifies to it all through man's experience. But we also have one who came to take away our sin. Genesis 3 also prophesies of that. I want us to bow our heads in prayer.